Welcome to Last Orders, a Spike podcast. We've got a brilliant episode for you today with the great Rod Liddell. We discuss the war on smokers, the cultishness of Just Stop Oil, and Rod answers your questions about the sorry state of British politics. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked. I'm joined, as I am in every episode, by Chris Snowden from the IEA. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm all right, thanks. How are you, Tom? You well?
I'm very well, thank you very much.
Monkeypox all cleared up now?
It has, just about.
Excellent.
But still wearing
a
mask. Another episode. We're delighted to be joined in this episode by Rod Liddell, journalist and member of the Social Democratic Party. Rod, thanks so much for coming on the show.
A privilege and a pleasure to be here, mate.
So we've got lots to talk about today. And we might, given this is a nanny state podcast, we should probably talk about the normally anti-nanny state government, which is crumbling before our very eyes. Chris, obviously you were quite optimistic about the prospects of what might happen on the nanny state agenda on your beat under Liz Truss, given the fact that she was very on the same page on these particular issues. I mean, when by the time people listen to this podcast, Therese Coffey and what her thoughts are on on the smoking agenda might have been sort of crumbled into dust, essentially. But should we talk about what's been going on there? So there's been a lot of talk about the tobacco control plan. This is the long-running sort of Tory plan to make Britain smoke-free, or England, I should say, smoke-free by 2030. What's been going on with all that?
Yeah, I've actually been optimistic about the last three prime ministers regarding the nanny state. Even Theresa May, I remember saying that actually, I've looked at her voting record. I think she could be quite sound on this. I
really noted libertarian Theresa May.
Yeah, I think third time, you know, never again. With the smoke free thing, well, comes back to Theresa May, funnily enough. Mm-hmm. Part of her attempt at a legacy was that she was going to have this target that we be smoke-free, which counterintuitively means that less than 5% of the population smoke by 2030. And it was like the net zero thing. It's just like, well, you know, I'll set this target and leave somebody else to work out how to achieve it. And then obviously she disappeared. Boris Johnson took over. It didn't actually feature in the Conservative manifesto in 2019 at all. In fact, there was nothing about smoking in it. So Coffey was asked about this on the radio, and she basically said, I've never heard of it, was the gist. She goes, I don't know anything about it. I don't know if it's still a target. Don't know, you know, I'm really much more focused on doctors and the health service and COVID and the winter crisis that is looming. And this was then picked up. I think she was asked about it again, and she said, look, you know, whatever the government's policy is my policy, but I don't know what the government's policy is. And then it was noted that she'd voted against the ban on smoking in cars with kids. Mm. And so the headlines were of the order of, you know, Theresa Coffey wants people to smoke in cars with kids. And she's famously been pictured with a cigar. And of course, this is meant to be a very good look for a health secretary. And it was a bit of a storm in a teacup, really, because she hadn't actually said anything. She just said that she didn't really know anything about this. But it was then rumoured that the government's going to ditch this plan. And maybe it would have done. Who knows? We'll probably never know, will we? Let's face it. But yeah, that was the story. And yeah, for a brief second, it looked as if my optimism might be well placed, because it's the kind of thing that Coffey would ditch. It's the kind of thing that Liz Truss probably would ditch and not want to be that bothered, apart from the usual anti-smoking agitators. But as you say, we may well be seeing a reversion to previous policy quite soon.
And how do you feel about that reversion to previous policy positions, Rod? Because I know the SDP is probably of a more paternalistic bent maybe on these questions than me or Chris might be. So how do you feel about these?
I suppose it is paternalistic. Yeah. How do I feel personally? It's irrelevant to me because I've given up smoking much as I'm sort of given up 9/10 of my drinking. So
we caught you at a great time to talk about.
Well, indeed. And it infuriates me, to be honest. I mean, I will never go back to smoking. I mean, I think once you've kicked it, and that's it. It just doesn't figure in my life anymore. But I resent deeply the fact that I was forced to give up smoking. And, of course, this was part of the government's plan. Mm-hmm. The government wanted me to give up smoking, and it did so by charging me a criminal amount of money for my cigarettes. I was paying £800 a month for cigarettes, you know, which is a mortgage. And finding it more difficult to find cigarettes, finding it more difficult to buy the sort of brand I wanted, being forced to go outside in railway stations and so on, and in pubs to sort of shelter from the howling wind in some doorway to have a tab. You know, it had just become an impossible way to live one's life, especially if you smoked the number of cigarettes, which I did. Mm. So in a sense, they won. I mean, not in a sense, they won this nanny state policy, which was also full of lies. You know, I'm sorry to say it. I don't doubt, just in case a thoracic surgeon listening, you know, I don't doubt that smoking is very bad for your health. And there are certain ways in which my health has improved since I gave up smoking, and certain ways in which it hasn't as well. But there is it is that terrible thing when science becomes conflated with ideology, and where expertise is cherry-picked in order to support this fascistic line that we must get rid of smokers. Mm. And an awful lot of it is based on untruths, you know. And I still don't believe, and I get these encomiums from the National Health Service every few days congratulating me as if I was a well-behaved five-year-old child, you know, for having given up smoking, and telling me that my chances of having a stroke have reduced by 50%. I don't believe you. I do not believe
you. Just overnight.
Overnight. I just don't believe it. They also say that my chances of getting lung cancer will have reduced by 50% within 4 years. I don't believe you. I just don't believe them. You know, because all of this data is cherry-picked. And the problem is that I suppose it did get to me and that I did believe them for a while. Which is why I gave up smoking. You know, it was in there with the inconvenience of smoking and the cost of smoking. Was that saying, God, well, you're bound to die? So immediately I gave up smoking. I thought, well, I must live forever now. Mm-hmm. You know, I did have that feeling that this one thing which every doctor tells you, that's the thing that's going to kill you, well, I'm not going to die then. That mm-hmm. must be it.
I read in your Spectator piece that you almost immediately got COVID, which I found interesting.
No, it is interesting, and I don't think there's any coincidence.
Do you know about all the evidence?
Yeah, I know all the evidence of smoking and COVID, which was deliberately, you know, suppressed by governments. In France, they were giving out nicotine patches and tablets to COVID patients, and I've never had flu. You know, and so I'm waiting for flu this Christmas because I suspect that smoking probably prevents some of these illnesses. Mm-hmm. Just as, you know, you never hear that smoking's also beneficial if you have Parkinson's disease, for example.
Mm-hmm. No, you can't talk about these things.
You can't talk about these things. And so my annoyance is that I feel a lesser man for having given in to these fuckers for a start. And for succumbing to a propaganda which I deeply mistrust, though I am financially a lot better off for it mm-hmm. as a consequence.
I mean, also your piece and your own experience sort of gives the lie to one of the things that underpins so much of this propaganda, which is addiction as well, this idea that it's not just smoking, but people talk about it in relation to food and all sorts of other things,
yeah.
that it's just impossible to kick, they're already weak-willed, you know, and you just stop like that, as many people...
I think it's another big lie, and I think it's true of alcohol, and I think it's true of smoking, and I think it's a lie about how difficult it is. It was no difficult for me whatsoever to give up smoking, just none. And I'm not the most strong-willed person in the world by a long margin. Indeed, one of the reasons I never took many drugs as a kid was that I was always worried that I was very weak-willed and would succumb to drug addiction. So I stayed away from them. But drinking, absolutely no difficulty whatsoever, nil, zero, no fucking 12 steps. It was one step. You know, I'm not drinking. You know, and again, I'm not terribly well strong-willed. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm suggestible, gullible. many, many bad things. And of course, there's a vast industry. I mean, there's two things. Firstly, there's a vast industry which is built up around dealing with people who wish to give up. Mm-hmm. You know, this kind of... These counselling, the counselling industry, and the industry of people who wish to assuage your addictions, and secondly, in order to demonise these products, they overstate the addictive powers of both alcohol and smoking. You know, I gave up smoking and I had a pack of 20. There were about 15 left, open in front of me on the kitchen table every day. There was absolutely no problem whatsoever giving up smoking. There was a bit of a pang on the first night. I thought, oh, I could do with a fag. Mm. And then I thought, nah, you used to smoke. You don't anymore. You know, it's over. And once the second day was out of the way, it was just plain sailing. I didn't even think about it. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. Sometimes I find myself reaching for something, but that is nothing to do with nicotine, and it's nothing to do with the addictive qualities of cigarettes. It's to do with the fact that I'm a very habitual person who does things habitually, and it's that reaching for something when I'm in a certain situation. Mm-hmm. But these days, there's absolutely no problem. So, no, we're lied to, Tom. That's the truth. We're lied to.
And yet they've been very brutally effective, at least in your case, but in many others as well, Chris. Because, you know, we talk about how ridiculous a lot of these plans and policies are. I mean, some of the luckily rejected plans recently about, you know, raising the smoking age by a year until it goes up to 99 or whatever.
Well, it hasn't definitely been rejected. New Zealand is doing it.
New Zealand's doing it.
And they're also taking the nicotine.
New Zealand would do
as well.
But have they won on this issue, I guess, is what I'm saying, because of the fact that, I mean, even in the space of a generation, a relatively heavy smoking habit has gone, has become a luxury good, effectively, as Rod was talking about. So, you know, is there much going back from this? Things have changed anyway?
There was what I found quite a sinister editorial in the Times when this mini row boiled over, which said that, you know, there's always, of course, a balance to be struck between individual liberty and public health. But there is now common consent that the government should effectively stamp out smoking. Yeah. And I thought, this is a terrible way to look at things in a supposedly free society. And this is exactly what John Stuart Mill was talking about when he talked about the tyranny of majority.
Yes,
it's like you push so... It's always worried me about the smoking thing. For years, they used various, basically, excuses. They tried to blame the tobacco industry for luring people in. That was essentially what it was. So we must ban the advertising because it's luring people in. And it got to the ludicrous point of saying we must get rid of the colours on the packs and the logos because that is also luring people. Now, they've done all that. They can't possibly accuse the tobacco industry of having any marketing might whatsoever because it's been completely neutered. And so their argument now is essentially most people don't like smoking.
Yeah.
You don't want to be in that place, you know? And if you substitute smoking or if you substitute something like, you know, religious freedom or homosexuality for smoking in that, then you see how sinister a development that is. So it's the worst possible justification for it, but it's really all they've got left. And also they're right, you know, that most people are anti-smoking. That was the headline in New Statesman for some bloody doctor, Dan Goyle.
Well, that's
because
they've been told for 30 years that they have to be. I say I'm gullible. I wasn't that gullible 25 years ago when Ash started saying, no, we don't want to ban smoking. We just want to ban secondary smoke in certain places, you know. I thought, no, you don't. you want it banned. And I was right, you know. This is the most annoying thing about it. The treating us, as you would call it nanny state, but the treating us as if we're, you know, 5 or 6 years old. Aren't we doing terribly well now with these? I preferred the me that smoked to the one which is currently in existence.
And so, having given up smoking, you've given a rousing appeal to listeners to do likewise.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. It's how you know you can trust it. This is the important thing. But also the figure of the smoker has been so demonised kind of culturally. I mean, there's always these kind of guidelines that you see slip out about not, you know, just not being able to depict it on television, almost more so than any other vice, it does, which...
Much more so, yeah.
Because in other ones, they're kind of almost celebrated nowadays. You know, smoking weed is celebrated as a better alternative to drinking and all the rest of it. But that kind of image of the kind of, you know, yellow-stained fingered smoker and all the rest of it is just fair game, often because it has a sort of class connotation. I guess,
well, the television thing is hilarious. I mean, and indeed in film, you know, and it was the idea that I remember the guidelines where they said... that people getting into a car in films should henceforth be shown putting their seatbelt on. And there should be no smoking. And you just imagine mean streets.
Buckle up.
Bring a seatbelt.
Yeah. Put your motherfucking seatbelt. Stub that out. But then increasingly advertising and film is not a reflection of the world, but a reflection of what our liberal elite wishes the world to be.
Mm-hmm. And we've touched on drugs a bit here, Chris, but should we talk a little bit about the recent news on that front? All sorts of cabinet ministers have been freelancing recently, sort of filling the void left by diminishing political authority. Suella Braverman has been talking about upgrading weed to Class A status, which has caused a lot of risk recently. There's also been, which seems to be pushing in the opposite direction to a lot of other places around the world, particularly America. What did you make of this? I mean, it seems like she's just signalling maybe for a future leadership contest or something. I don't think anyone thinks they're going to get anything like that through, but what do you make of all of that?
Is that popular with the Tory membership? I don't know. I'm not sure. I think the Tory membership's probably a bit more modern than that these days. I assume it's just their own personal belief, actually. And to be fair, Downing Street did shut it down, so this isn't going to happen. But yeah, there's this idea that the Truss administration is some ultra-libertarian sect that has somehow taken over the Conservative Party. But actually, if you look at what they've done, aside from, well, not even aside from the tax things, I mean, a penny off income tax is an absolutely classic Tory policy. It's the kind of thing that every Tory leader for generations has promised, right? It's been portrayed as being like ultra-free market because people got it in for Liz Truss. But yeah, look at the other stuff. That, I mean, nothing's really been announced. It's just all rumour. Like this, you know, we're going to get rid of the tobacco plan. It's just a rumour. And this was a proposal from a admittedly quite senior member of the government. But yeah, we want to put cannabis into Class A to really teach people a lesson, which, to be clear, means potentially, and this will almost certainly never happen, but potentially somebody selling weed could go to prison for life as opposed to whatever it is, 7 years under Class B.
Nothing at the moment. I mean, it's effectively.
Yeah, right. I mean, this is obviously true in practice, but it could happen. But she also said that she wants to see, and this is worse, really, she wants to see random drug testing in offices, which strikes me as not very ultra-libertarian whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And pretty much everything that's been rumoured or kind of mooted has been not at all libertarian.
Yeah.
And this idea that they're all... Well, if they are all libertarians, they're keeping it very quiet.
How do you feel about this, Rod? Should it be
on the testing in offices? It's obnoxious, and it was for smoking as well, which I know they did in America. Absolutely obnoxious. I don't have a big problem with cannabis being moved up to a Class A drug, and I think that there are variants of cannabis which would fall under the heading of cannabinoids, which are every bit as dangerous as Class A drugs, certainly as dangerous as cocaine. We know about the health risks to people who use cannabis, but it's a kind of quotidian approach which we have in our country at the moment, that if we direct our attention to smoking... I don't know if you heard that. That was a can of beer being opened, by the way, which is, and an alarm immediately went off in the background.
This is what it's like at the IEA.
It is, absolutely.
They're very policed work.
Yes, that's right. Because if Liz Truss announces something and immediately an alarm goes off, then it's very similar.
That sound here in the background is Mark Littlewood running over to
Congress. I think that I don't take the same lax approach. I'm slightly more Peter Hitchens-y on drugs than you might expect. In that, I think they're damaging. We know that they're damaging. We know the difficulties they cause for people in terms of psychosis, paranoia, and various other neurological problems. And therefore, I do not see any case whatsoever for the decriminalisation. And I have no objection to cannabis being made a Class A drug, none whatsoever.
I mean, as you were saying, we sort of differ on this particular point.
Yeah.
One thing that I find strange, though, is the celebration of cannabis as well.
It's weird.
And this kind of idea that it's a better alternative to the demon drink, even though it's the boring drug.
Well, you know what this is, isn't it? This is the usual self-flagellating whitey business. That they think that cannabis, with some justification, particularly for Rastafarians, where it is part of their religion, that weed is the preserve, particularly of British African Caribbean people, and therefore it's something to be championed along with rap music and stabbing. I don't agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think that is either a fair depiction of Britain's African Caribbean population or something which by itself is worthy of championing. And I think it's more whitey liberal self-abnegation and knee-bending.
But the problem is if you put cannabis in Class A, what do you put in Class B?
I don't know.
There's no point having a ranking based supposedly on harm if you're just going to put everything in Class
Licorice.
A to make a...
tobacco. That's right, yes. But, I mean, the same thing has happened in America and happened 20-odd years ago. I used to visit a place in America called Sausalito, which is on the in Marin County, just across the bay from San Francisco, which is probably the most liberal city in the world, you know. And there, smoking was banned, but cannabis was subsidised by City Hall.
Hmm.
You know, and that seemed to me an absurdity, because both of them are, of course, you know, dangerous to health. I mean, I don't quite see why you would elevate one, and of course, it's all tied up with the liberals' loathing of big business.
Yeah.
So perhaps what we do is we do legalise cannabis and let, you know, Wills or someone take it over. And then maybe the lefties will hate cannabis as well.
I mean, Richard Branson family said they'd be selling weed into
virgin cannabis.
Exactly. And all that
if anything
so maybe
put you off taking drugs, it's Richard Branson.
Inviting you to the island.
Inviting you to the island. And with an endless tape loop of tubular fucking bells.
Have you joined Spike Supporters yet? Spike Supporters is our thriving donor community where those who donate to Spike regularly can access all kinds of exclusive perks. You can comment on articles, get free tickets to events, and much more. Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters. That image has somehow worked perfectly to transition into the strange world of environmental protest, which has burst out onto the streets of London again in the past week or so. Just Stop Oil, which is the latest sort of single issue offshoot of Extinction Rebellion, have been blocking roads, gluing themselves to things, de-locking themselves together by the neck and so on. And it feels like the farce has sort of run its course as far as people are really wondering why the police can't deal with this, why this continues to carry on. There was this fascinating revelation that Mark Rowley, the new head of the Met, said that blocking roads, gluing yourself to the tarmac for hours and then does not necessarily constitute serious disruption under the law. Chris, I know that you take a particularly actually authoritarian line. You think they should
absolutely
be hosed down and so on.
Yes.
But what did you make of these recent
rounds? Very
of
right-wing on this issue.
Pray tell.
There's a beautiful photo. They did it at Scotland Yard, right? Yeah. I'm always saying when these things happen, like, where were
the
police?
Spraying the sign of
literally
paint, weren't they?
Yeah. Spraying Scotland Yard. No policemen around doing anything about it. There's this wonderful picture afterwards in which the Scotland Yard sign is just covered in orange paint. There's dripping orange paint all around it.
Yeah.
And about 12 coppers in yellow vests sort of standing around as if they're kind of protecting the paint in some way. It just sums up Britain in 2022, really. Unbelievable that they keep getting away with this. And, yeah, you try and find some, you know, reasonable explanation for why these coppers are literally, like, giving people, feeding them water out of the bottle as they're sat there.
Hang on, I don't know if it's apocryphal or if it's just exaggerated. I was told that in the latest protests, the coppers had actually asked the protesters if they wanted a cup of tea and a sandwich.
I can't believe it.
I mean, I don't...
There's definitely been loads of reports, stuff like that over the years.
So they're turning into a kind of catering service for these fucking middle-class... Anyway, I'll let you carry on with your.
They are extremely posh. I mean, this is one thing that comes up again and again. Like, they're very cut glass accents, particularly with these two Just Stop Oil protesters.
Oh, Phoebe Plummer.
Is that what she was called?
Phoebe Plummer.
I mean, she was the one who threw the soup at Van Gogh sunglasses, yes. Wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, but it was organic.
Roll right off.
Yeah. But I mean, she's not from the back streets of Middlesbrough, is she? Phoebe Plummer.
So these two women went into, what is it, National Gallery, wearing just Stop Oil T-shirts. Yeah. Now, I understand they could have had a coat on as they went in, but by the time they got anywhere near the painting, they were wearing very clear black and white Just Stop Oil T-shirts with a can of tomato soup in hand. Somebody, at least one person following behind with a camera or phone, filming the whole thing. Where are the police? Where were the security guards? I mean, there are lots of people, generally speaking. You know,
you're taking photos.
Right, exactly. Right. You're holding your camera to take a photo of the painting and they're pouncing.
Yeah.
And then I saw another video from a different angle, from a bit further back. And it just looked like a press conference. I mean, it just looked completely organized with loads of people with cameras who clearly knew this was going to happen. No security around, except possibly to protect the protesters. So it seems like our institutions are very much in on this, doesn't it? Including a large part of the police.
There is a lot of form for that as well. Like the elite celebration of these protesters is something that you can't really ignore. And of course, it's going to inform the police response as well. There was one story, it was from one of the people who was one of the protesters, but when I think it was the first batch of Extinction Rebellion protests, when some of them ended up in a courtroom, the judge essentially praised them.
No, he did, yes.
And he talked about how, you know, you're not like the usual people I have to deal with, yes, and your cause is right, essentially. And this is something you see all the time.
It's so nice to hear someone speaking the Queen's English.
Which wasn't the kind of reception which was greeted by the Brexit protesters, nor indeed the anti-vaxxers. You know, they were considered to be mentally ill, which they may well be, but it is also mentally ill to think that you should kill as many pensioners as possible in order to destroy the oil industry.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing which enrages us, of course, and enrages all of us, is that these people think we are not aware that there is an energy problem, that we're not aware that there's climate change, that we're not aware of it. We all are. And these people rather have the kind of mindsets of evangelical Christians who think that they alone are in possession of the truth.
But more than that, it's that the government isn't aware. That the government hasn't been spending years making this their absolute top priority.
It is a massive piece of self-indulgence by these people. And it's self-indulgent of the state as well.
Yeah.
But it's self-indulgent in the same way that, you know, that ludicrous chief of police took a knee to BLM, and then you had other coppers taking a knee to BLM in right outside Scotland Yard. You know, it's that the police have become politicised, and politicised from the liberal left.
How long do either of you think it will take before they actually turn to actual terrorism? It seems to me a non-trivial risk. I think they will get so carried away that it will start. I think
it's an interesting point because of the fact that as you were gesturing to their Rod, the cultish aspect of this, the kind of apocalyptic aspect of this is getting worse and worse. And that's why you're seeing the protests not become more extreme, throwing, you know, soup at a great work of art. But, you know, who was that girl who poured shit over that statue of Captain
Tom? Did you see the woman who tried to set herself on fire?
Oh, the set off. Completely forgotten about
that. Did you see that video?
Woman,
another very posh woman. She said, every day we are setting ourselves on fire until the UK government bans domestic flights. She then pours lighter fluid on her arm, sets fire to it, and then just howls in agony, seemingly surprised that her arm is on fire having done this. It's a very, very funny video.
It's going down a very creepy... The writer Clive Martin described it as environmentalism's helter-skelter period. And I think that's not over
the
top.
They do believe it, right? I mean, the part of it is obviously just attention-seeking.
Yeah. Wasn't she using a kind of carbon-based fuel in order to set herself alight?
Yes, and the paintings are oil paintings.
Yes.
No, exactly. You've got to stop that. But I've always sort of resisted the idea that these people are sort of like eco-terrorists or something. I think that implies a level of fearsomeness and physical courage of which they're not actually possessing.
Well, I think courageous. The guy who put himself on the goal at Everton was pretty courageous.
You don't want to upset
He actually did get some jail time.
Where was that?
To see.
Everton.
Everton, yeah. He grotted himself to the goalpost.
Yeah, it might have helped match. Everton a bit, might it?
There is something quite... Also, these groups, he's now technically excommunicated from Extinction Rebellion, but these offshoots, Roger Hallam.
Nutter,
who not only bears a passing resemblance to Charles Manson, but also in terms of if you actually read what he writes, it's really creepy. Talks about, you know, complete societal breakdown, people breaking into your house and raping your mother and laughing and all this sort of stuff. And at some point, that's going to trickle through to surely right, more. Because
did you listen to what these toffs were saying at the, mm-hmm. The National Gallery? They was made this stupid false dichotomy between, you know, what is the value of art compared to the value of the planet? Yeah. It's not, well, you destroying art does not save the planet. But anyway,
no, but it's you can.
It's a very easy, you know, a terrorist would make a similar point in saying what is the value of one life, mm-hmm. or 10 lives or 100 lives compared to the value of the billions of people who are going to die mm-hmm. from climate change. So you can easily see it, I think, tipping over to that kind of terrorism, not least because this is clearly attracting extremists.
Yeah. And they're all very anti-human as well.
I'm probably less convinced in that I do think, like you tell me, I think this is basically the middle class's day out in London, you know, and they do a bit of protesting, then they go to, you know, the Neil Yard's dairy with some nice cheese, and then they go home. But it's also the horseshoe effect that that it's become so far to the left, and especially within the Green movement, there is that edge to the Green movement, which is not a million miles away from fascism. And indeed has been fascistic in the past. And you look at the soil, the Soil Society, what's it called? The
Soil Association.
Soil Association. All of this has its roots in back to the earth, back to nature. And
sort of aristocratic reactionary politics.
That's right, yeah, exactly. And you saw it with Henry Williamson, you know, who wrote Tark of the Otter and was obviously a card-carrying fascist. You saw it with Hitler, who was also similarly this great myth of us getting back to the land, which was the ideal of the Nazi state, to get back to the roots of the land. You see it also, much as I admire him, in Roger Scruton's writings as well. So there's always been this kind of annihilationist view of the extreme Greens, which teeters into fascism.
And what's interesting, because we sort of talk about at what point it might tip over, but also some of these sort of far-right terrorist shootings in America and elsewhere, those long manifestos have what they call like eco-fascist parts of them. People don't talk about it. I think it was in Texas or one of these ones, which obviously I think he went down there just to murder Latinos, essentially. But for his manifesto in particular had all these kind of ecological themes in it, and people just choose not to talk about that stuff, you know.
No, that's right. And of course, you see it as well if you could ever be asked to, if you look at the writings of David Icke, where it genuinely does teeter right on the edge. And I think he met David Duke, the KKK candidate from Louisiana. It's very, very right-wing stuff, and it's not particularly pleasant. And I also wonder about these organizations. I mean, that basic point which I made at the beginning when we were talking about this, which is that they think we don't know about it. You know, I mean that's the first thing to address. How can you think we don't know about it? And if you are saying just stop oil, do you mean immediately? And what do you think that would mean for millions of people? You know, and it seems as if their arguments are built on a succession of non sequiturs. We know about climate change. We know something needs to be done to deal with it. And there are a few people who disagree with climate change. I'm not one of those. I think we have man-made climate change, and we need to deal with it. The idea that we are ignorant of it is an absurdity, an absurdity. And where have all these groups come from? You know, at first it was Extinction Rebellion. It was Stop Oil. It was Insulate Britain. It's the middle class finding something to do with their lives.
Insulate Britain's much more of a moderate wing, I was thinking.
Is it?
Like, compared to the ones who think we're going to be extinct and the ones who think we should stop oil. Insulating.
It seems more
revolutionary.
It seems more quaint because they're, you know, laying their bodies on the line for double glazing, which is not state of affairs.
Well, the ideology is still more moderate one, which is turn the thermos down a bit.
I will lay my life on the line.
Put on a jumper
for this particular.
Put on a jumper.
Make sure you never miss a Spiked article by signing up to Today on Spiked. Today on Spiked is our essential daily newsletter. It goes out every weekday evening with a roundup of all of the articles and podcasts that we published that day. And there's also some exclusive commentary from the Spiked team. To sign up, just go to spiked-online.com/newsletters. That's spiked-online.com/newsletters. We haven't got much time left, but we should get to the post bag section.
Post bag.
It's bulging, eh?
Where people can email in and tweet in their
has it been questions. Bulging?
It has been bulging this time around. And there's a lot of political questions as well, no doubt because of the fact that they knew that Rod was coming on the show today. So we're going to start off with this one from Kenny Given. He says there's a vacuum in the Tory party that's crying out for a Nigel Farage. If Farage sensationally joins the Tory party, all the Brexiteers and Boris Johnson faithful would endorse him and he'd be elected leader of the Tory party and win the next election. What do you think about that?
Kenny's delusional. I think where he's right is that there's a huge space opening up, which obviously I would like to see filled by the Social Democratic Party. I don't think there's a Farage-shaped hole in our politics. Farage was an extraordinary politician in that he achieved what he set out to do, and now that it's achieved, I don't think there's much more for him to do, and I don't see him coming back anytime soon either. Nor do I think that... the Richard Tice's reform or react or whatever the hell it's called is this seems to be again just a kind of satirite sprig, which I don't think has a great philosophical basis to it. I think that, you know, and I've thought this for years. I thought it when I was in the Labour Party that by and large the British people tend to want a government which is kind of economically leftish, you know, social market, a bit of a role for the state, but not on the level that John McDonnell would suggest, but is very conservative on social issues. And the SDP stands for that. The trouble is, you know, you look at the House of Commons, they're all liberals, nearly all liberals. And
in the worst sense of that word.
In the modern sense of that word. And you can say neoliberal, certainly neoliberal on foreign policy, which has been disastrous, you know, disastrous and murderous neoliberal foreign policy. So I think there is a space there, but, you know, you're met when you're a small party, as we are, with only, you know, 2,000 or so members. And it rises every week and we win council seats and stuff like that. But to break through, you either need PR or you need some massive defection or a celebrity, someone inane, preferably, someone utterly inane, suddenly saying that they... are a member of the SDP, someone from Strictly or something. You said, I'm now SDP. And then suddenly you go, you know, the rest of the country goes, I am as well now. So it's a rather jaundiced view of democracy. But there we are.
In terms of the SDP, because also you had your conference recently. John Cleese was in attendance.
He was, yes.
You've also had recent electoral successes in Leeds Council, I believe.
Yeah.
So what is the pitch? I mean, you've gestured to it there in relation to filling that kind of underserved demographic which leans left on economics and right on culture. But what is it that you think is going to really cut through voters?
Well, I mean, I have to say that when I've been out canvassing for the SDP, which I do a lot, by-elections and so on. And by-elections are, you know, people always say that by-elections are a good way for a small party to break through, but they're actually not anymore because you get 24 parties, you know, and you just get lost in this morass of shite, you know. And so it was that when we boldly stood in Hartlepool, put up a very good candidate and with good policies, we were narrowly beaten by the sex offender who was on the list. You know, we've been beaten by a sex offender, a witch, and a fascist recently. You know, and those are all in by-elections. Councils are far better in that they can see that you're a proper party, that you've got you've got roots in the community, and that's the way we've done it in Leeds. As I say, when I've been out canvassing, and I explain our economic policy, which is, you know, we believe, unlike Sakir, that we could nationalise the utilities, for example. We have no objection to that. Nationalise the rail companies and so on. And we also agree with a higher rate of income tax. So we are economically quite leftish. When I explain this to people, their eyes glaze over. When I say we also believe that a woman doesn't have a cock, When I say that to them, they say, yes, I'm voting for you. So I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever. And there is some resistance because we're a noble party, mm-hmm. you know, because we have this philosophical background,
yeah.
you know, and based in Tawny right back at the beginning mm-hmm. of the century, but also, you know, the gang of David Owen and all this, because there's that history there, there are people within the party who would balk at us launching an election bid based upon the fact that we are the party which will have no wokeness whatsoever, you know. And we've had 10 years of Tories, 7 years, but arguably 12 years. How many have we had? 2010, 12, I suppose, mm-hmm. 12. Who have done nothing about the forward march of wokery. Mm-hmm. We would, you know, immediately. And we know what we're doing. And I think the public... I think the culture war is as important, if not more important, than the economic stuff. I think that's the way it is at the moment, that one culture... The culture war is not a war between two equal sides. It's a kind of assault on the country by a small minority, but supported by a liberal elite. Or tacitly supported and sometimes explicitly supported by a liberal elite. And I think that is what the British people really, really don't like at all.
Mm. We had one question which was about the Labour Party as well, which I think is worth talking about and asking you about because of the fact
yeah,
that
sure.
Keir Starmer has, particularly with his last conference, you know, standing in front of the union flag, singing yeah. the national anthem and so yeah. on, there has been this sort of sense that he's found some sort of relatively comfortable position with those questions yeah. of nation identity and whatever. Personally, it feels like a bit of a triangulation between sort of New Labour and Blue Labour, and I think I know which one's going to win out in the end, but how do you feel about where he is?
Yeah, I mean, I think Keir Starmer has been underestimated, and I think he's done an incredibly good job with the Labour Party, almost to the degree that I would vote for them if there was no SDP candidate around. I think he's done a good job. That being said, I think he is absolutely hamstrung by his party in that he cannot. I do not believe for a minute that Sir Keir Starmer doesn't know what a woman is. I think Sir Keir Starmer could define a woman to you if you got him down in the pub with a curry, as he had, and a glass of beer. He would be able to tell you, yes, it's they don't have penises, Rod. You're quite right. I'm sure he would. I don't think he's in any doubt. Just as I suspect he was deeply uncomfortable when he took the knee.
Mm.
You know, though I think that's less obvious than the stuff on transgenderism. But he is hamstrung by a party which is no longer a party of the working class. It's a party of affluence, a party of considerable affluence, metropolitan affluence. And, you know, in London, Bristol, Liverpool, Manchester and so on, in those city centres, they will not put up with any revanchism on wokeism. Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, in a way, Starmer's right to have stood in front of the flag and sung the national anthem, because the one thing which you did get through at the 2019 election, when I was on the doorstep, you know, finding out what people thought, was they abhorred Jeremy Corbyn's lack of patriotism and his apparent support for any organisation or country which was opposed to our own. So the patriotism is one of the keys of that, but it's only part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he can do anything about the rest of it. And seems to have made no attempt to, and he will continually be hamstrung by it. You know, I don't think he can ever get away from that. Mm-hmm. I think he's caught.
He does seem to be a man who stands for nothing, but he knows which way the wind is blowing. Is that
I
fair
don't
enough,
I don't know that he does stand for nothing. You know, I think that's put to him because we had an overly ideological previous leader of the Labour Party. He's tilted it back to an approximation of Blairism. I don't see much Blue Labour in there
yeah.
at all. The nod to patriotism, I suppose, is mm-hmm. one bit of it. But no, I think he's kind of Blairite, which is an improvement on Corbyn, I suppose. Though I also, you know, would argue that actually some of the economic policies put forward by John McDonnell during the last election were actually quite popular with the Red Wall voters.
Definitely.
And that he's lost some of that radicalism, which might pull people over as well. I don't mind Keir. You know, I suppose it's because I'm, in a milieu where everyone fucking hates him.
The contrarian in you.
Well, it is probably the... But also, you know, my wife, who cannot abide the Labour Party, just rails about Keir Starmer. I don't quite see it. I think he's done an incredibly good job, very cleverly, in 2 years, you know. Mm-hmm. If only the Tories had someone like that. You
know? Mm. Of which they have no one.
Of which they have no one. They are fucked, aren't they?
Not a political analyst, but it's not looking good, is it?
It's very safe. When Jeremy Hunt is essentially the Prime Minister of the country, you know something's gone horribly
yes. Well, we of course want Jeremy Hunt there, and better still if we can give Penny Mordaunt an important role, because that will just finish the party off completely. She's not a Conservative. You know, I think she's one of the worst people in politics. And the more publicity, the more her face is the face of the Conservative Party, the more votes we will get.
And on that note, Rod, thank you so much for joining us.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.